Here I am once again. My name is Steve Welch, and I'm still an alcoholic. So myself, I believe I'm very fortunate in meeting the speakers, AA speakers of tonight. This man has put me on a boil as far as I'm concerned, so I won't waste any more time. I give you Johnny H. of Lakewood. Hi everybody, my name is Johnny and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here tonight, sober, fully clothed and in my right mind. Now that may not make a lot of sense to a lot of people, but I like to remember it because it kind of puts me where I belong in here. Because you see, 16 years ago, about this time, I was crawling around on my hands and knees in a cell in solitary confinement in the National Security Penitentiary. And because of the loving God who has expressed himself through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's no longer necessary for me to crawl around on my hands and knees like an animal. And if I got nothing else out of the hole to do with, I could pass up and go home. But I'd like to tell you how I got to where I was 16 years ago. I got this particular through my own power. I worked at it. I was in search of something that I didn't even dream existed. It seems to be a common fallacy with most alcoholics that I've run into. They're always looking for something that they don't think even exists. I don't know whether that's a fallacy of the disease of alcoholism or not. I really don't know much about anything. I'm a consultant and a fellow or a counselor on the disease of alcoholism. I am an example of good brother and good sister for over 15 years and 8 months of my life. Loved me enough to me to put anything in the chemical solution in my system. And for that I'm extremely grateful. And I'd like to stand here tonight and tell you I had something to do with that. But I didn't have much to do with that. I just been showing up for duty. And people have been telling me what I've been doing wrong on a lot. I don't know, in my group, I'm a member of the Big Big Group in Delta, Iowa, this week on Monday night, and I personally think it's the best group of alcoholics anonymous in the world. And I urge you, if you don't think that about your own home group, then you get busy and start doing something about your home group. I really don't know a lot about a lot of things, but there's one thing I do know. I love alcoholics now. Because I'm standing here, good, bad, and different. As a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, in good standing. And I'm a good standing member of Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm an active participating member of my own home group. That means I get to mop the floors on Monday night. And that's kind of tough when you're the founder of the group. Kind of drag enemies right out the door, and that kind of doesn't do too much for you when you're a big shot. And you know what they do with big shots, don't you? Those are the folks that with about one elbow bend away from oblivion. There aren't any in Alcoholics Anonymous turns out. I found out that every time I get to be a big shot in Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody sticks a mop in my hand in my home group and says, "Here, big shot, not the floor." I spent my entire lifetime looking for this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know that when I was out there looking. I don't really know whether I was born alcoholic or not. I've been weird. I was weird. I just was always weird. I had a very average family when I left out in life. I had a drunken mother, a drunken father, 4 drunken uncles, 3 drunken aunts, and a drunken grandfather. And I like to see them tell you that I'm an alcoholic. But that's not true either. I really don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I'm just tickled to death and I know what's wrong with me. Because I just thought I was weird on the life before I came here. I, I looked out on this thing called life, and I looked out on it with very high standards of living. And I looked out on this thing called life, and I thought, man, there's got to be more to this life than what I see. And I didn't understand that, because way down deep in my gut, I felt like I didn't belong where I was at. I looked around that family of mine, I wandered around and looked at them, and I said, I didn't belong to these people. I felt like I was on the outside of a candy store, looking through the window of this candy store, and seeing all the goodies inside of it, and I always thought, man, maybe if I could just get my fingers through the glass. But the only thing that would have happened was I stuck my nose up there and it got hurt. And I didn't understand what was going on. I could almost taste the candy. And I knew I'd never be able to have it, because right along with that feeling of not being belonging anywhere, I had a terrible feeling of unworthiness. I didn't understand that for a long, long time. I didn't belong anywhere, and I didn't understand that. And I didn't deserve anything because I didn't belong anywhere, and I didn't understand that. And then I turned right around and hated everything that I saw. Then I had this thing going off inside of me that I'm going to find this deal called out. And I had these high principles of mine. Very high principles. And I don't know how you are, but I was born with this high set of principles, and I found out that I'd set them out very cheaply. That I'd give them up just high ideas until it came time to set them out. And I really have to get the first time I ever remember setting out my principles. I had these uncles and these aunts in this little town and family that we lived in. My uncles were the town bulldoggers and my aunts were the town prostitutes. And God, I hated them because they made me ashamed of them. Well, but I found out on Saturday night if I put my hand in my uncle's hand and smiled very sweetly, and put my hand in my aunt's hand and smiled very sweetly, they would take me downtown and buy me a nickel ice cream cone. And I didn't like that, but God, the ice cream cone tasted too good. You know, and I figured, you know, if you sell that cheap for nickel, it doesn't make any difference. Because then you can kind of justify it a little bit. Well, the ice cream tasted all right, and I really don't like them, but cut the difference if you get a nickel ice cream cone. And I found out they were just a step from there to oblivion. That's the first thing that I remember. When I was a kid, I used to run around and try to find this thing that I knew existed, that I didn't think I'd ever find, but I thought I'd run around and look for it anyhow. And I used to go to Steve Church working for this thing. I used to go to church on Sunday morning with my grandmother. And I sat in this church with my grandmother and my older brother, and the guy who was sitting near the third would stand and say things I didn't even understand. He'd say, you're supposed to love and honor and respect your parents. He'd say, you're supposed to love your best. And I didn't. I hated it. I didn't even understand that. I just hated the things that I didn't even understand. I thought to myself, man, I'm weird. Now this is starting to death inside of people are going to find out that I was hating when I was supposed to be loving. I felt very guilty about that. And I didn't know what was going on. And then my grandmother came along and gave me her God. And I guess it's the thing that I used to cop out for the rest of my life and used to cop out a great deal of the times of death. My grandmother came along and she told me about a God who punished little boys who were bad. And I couldn't understand this God because I couldn't understand why I was sitting around the place, scared and cold and hungry and not knowing where my parents were. I didn't understand why this God had punished me and I hadn't done anything. So somewhere along the line I kind of got the idea God didn't like me too much. If he didn't like me, I wouldn't like him. And I kind of had it all confused and backwards and upside down. Instead of having our Father God, I had an image of the God Father. And kind of say, that's where I was. You know, have you ever had anybody in your life who just don't like? So every time you think of it, you want to split. So that's what that God thought about me. They were doing down there. He said, well, you know, if you're born in this favor, you're never going to get any better, so you might as well just go on and do what you're going to do anyhow. And I hated booze and everything that went with it because that was one of my other things that I blamed. I blamed booze for being the way it was because everybody in my family was drunk. And I remember nice things like a little kid. I used to go with my grandmother on the way to church, be with my grandfather out of jail. And Sunday morning, we'd stand down there, my older brother and I, and I just knew that everybody in town was driving by and knew how we were there. And I tried to hide under the steps and behind bushes and things. Because they were going to go in and get my drunken grandfather out of jail. And my grandfather would do strange things. He'd come home from wherever he was getting drunk. And he'd be a little tired and a little cold. He'd build in a fire. It had to be somebody's house or barn or something like that. Grandpa. He'd just get cold and build in a fire. And he's a strange little fella. You know, and he'd be a little Irish jig out there while it was burning down. And with or without his clothes on. They didn't make much difference to Grandpa. And we'd have to go down each Sunday and bail him out. But there I sit in my life, scared and frightened and lonely and confused and apart from everything and not a part of everything. I know what was really going on in life and hating everything was from. Hating that bird because it robbed me in the birthright. Hating that God because he took me out to spit on it from time to time. I didn't know what was going on. One day I got into my own beer and juice and took a drink of alcohol. It was the most fantastic thing that ever happened to me in my life. Well, they went down inside me and kind of blew all them things out from inside me that I didn't understand. And alcohol kind of just took and put me together. So it's the most fantastic thing I ever tried out in my life. It felt like I was a bunch of pips and pieces floating around out there in life, and I took a drink of alcohol, and it put me together. And didn't talk to God, I guess. I talked to my first drink of alcohol. My God, I'm like my old man. And from that day until the day I cleaned out all this anonymous, I never took a drink of alcohol willingly in the life. I never took a part of life that was tasted. I never took a part of life that was tickled my teeth when it went down there. I took it for what happened when it got down there. It seemed like to me that there was a hole in my gut, and alcohol was a sewing machine that just flipped it right up real quick and made it okay. And I knew that alcohol wasn't the answer to this burden of living. So when you're living in the black fingers of mentalness, and you're standing in the black all your life, and you're looking out through this window and seeing other people in the sunshine, and you figure, I'm never worthy enough to stand in that sunshine, but maybe I can get into the grave fingers of this burden of living. And that's where alcohol took me to, the grave fingers of the burden of living. And if you're like me, and you're unworthy, and you're apart from everything, that's all right. If you think you're never going to get nothing any better, the grave fingers is better than the black. I figured a pattern for drinking from my first drink that I followed for 20 years of my life, and it never varied. I took a drink of alcohol, and 2 days later, they pulled me off the moon with a bridge and stood me in front of a judge, and he was in here to the Hutchins of the Farm School. I was in that school a little while, and they put me in a foster home, and I was in the foster home a little while, and there was a knock on the door one day, and my mother showed up with a piece of paper, and said the judge had given me permission to take me out of the state of Kansas and bring me to the state of California. So we left the state of Kansas, my older brother, my younger brother, my mother, and I, and ran away to California. And my mother was saying the same thing. My mother said, we get to California, things are going to be different. And I don't know what my older brother or my younger brother thought about that, but then I thought about it, because I wanted to be different. You see, I had an idea in the back of my mind, you see. I had an idea that we could get that house in the hill with a white picket fence, and my mother would be sitting there with that crispy apron with a tray full of cookies and milk, then this thing wouldn't be full of mud. And the insanity wouldn't be all around me. And I wouldn't hurt them. I wouldn't be scared. And I wouldn't be a part of everything. I'd be a part of the story. That was my whole thing. If I could just get it like that, this thing would be okay. Well, that's the alcoholic delusion, for God's sake. If I could just shake up the world out there, this thing won't drive me crazy, and I won't have to drink that alcohol. You see, when we left California on the way to California, I thought about that. We left the one room shack in Kansas and came to California and got us a one room shack with a bathroom. My mother got me a couple of new answers, and then it goes from Kansas. I don't care. And I went on in the street and got drunk. And I made a fantastic discovery. I found out that alcohol would do the same thing to me in California that it did in Kansas. And in my crazy way of thinking, it was the only thing that I'd ever found that ever did the same thing in succession. So I was at a point in my life where I was tired of people telling me things they weren't going to do. I was getting tired of getting my head from dreams and aspirations and that high off the ground and having somebody come along and kick the stool out from underneath me. But I found out if I threw a brick to a woman and got me a bottle of my perpetual red wine and drank it, that it never lied to me. But I did exactly what I anticipated it doing. So it went down there and kind of sticked up the hole in my belly, and it made everything all right. It took me out of the blackness and put me on the gray and made things okay. And that's where I was. I got drunk and went to juvenile hall, not early. I was in juvenile hall a little wet bit, and my mother come to visit me and said the same thing. She said, I love you and I miss you, and you thought that things were going to be different. And I thought about that. A couple of weeks later, we went in front of the judge, and he seemed to me that he was staying in the film school, and my mother stood up there to lie in the field.
And I thought about them. And I went back and sat for a couple of weeks, and my mother came to visit me, and she said, I love you, and I miss you, and you come home, things going to be different. And a couple of weeks later, we went from the bridge, and he came to me to hear you say your poem school, and my mother should have been around the field. And I started to sing. And I think one of the strangest things you can ask an alcoholic to do, and he's a practicing alcoholic, is to sing. Because I can trust the most maddening thing that ever happened to me, because I'm religious. And I'm obsessed very easily about things that gave me great comfort. Even today, I can become obsessed with things that give me comfort. Very easily. And I don't know, I think it's the thing that drives most people seem crazy when they start to deal with people like that. Because we're really very medically, clinically, or psychiatric, you need to deal with an obsession. You know? God has to know. That's the same thing. You know, I found the Bill Wilson when he put our program on Alcoholics Anonymous together. So there were many things that he could have given our illness. He was a number of things that he wanted to give. But isn't it amazing that he gave us something that there is no medical, clinical, psychiatric evaluation of, and it's an expression of the mind. Now, I don't know how you are with obsession, but I'm in the fairly wrong. Because I've lived with a man a lot. And I live with him a great deal of time today, and I don't know how obsessions start off in your life, but with me, they stop. You know, like a sprinkler in the bed. Oh! You look good down through there, don't you, Pat? Well, if you come back again, you know, and the first thing about that obsession is, there it is. And it's all you can see. So if the people face the same circumstances or condition, it doesn't make any difference. It's obsession. And obsession is obsession is obsession is obsession. And if you're like me, you got to do one or two things with that obsession. You got to roll it out. Or you got to destroy it and pray about it and let God remove it. Now, I didn't know about praying about it and let God remove it before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. So before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my obsession had to be eliminated through a process of trial and error. And it had to be destroyed for the most of the world. When I was doing that hall for 3.5 years, I became obsessed with the idea that I was going to get home someday, and there was going to be a little house in the hill with a white picket fence, and my mother was going to be standing there with a tray full of cookies in it. And once a month, we went into a courtroom, and my mother stood there, and married in shining armor with a attorney, fighting for me. And the obsession mounted and grew and mounted and grew. And 3.5 years we went through this deal. We went into a courtroom one day, and the judge had continued with my mother to put me in a boys' home in San Fernando Valley. And we got to the boys' home, and the superintendent said, if you're a good kid, we're going to let you go home on a home trip in 30 days. He thought I was good. 30 days came and went, but Taylor's on another truck, and they brought us out of the valley. And listen, all day trip, we went to New Seaway those days. So got us off in downtown Hollywood. I had to run the 50-year subway car right downtown Los Angeles. So we got off to run down the 59 to 50-year red car right off the road where Taylor lives. And I got off the ground running at the streetcar. Just running for all I was worth, because this thing that I've lived for all my life is going to happen right out there around that corner and down the street. And excitement and anticipation is mounting, and my head is pounding, and my guts are coming apart at the seams. And round the corner and down the street and into the back door of my mother's house, there was a drunken party going on there. Nothing had changed. He put me. I'd spent 3.5 years in juvenile hall, and I'd heard a lot of strange things. I heard things like everybody's a liar and everybody's a thief. Never believed anybody used to come because that's the sign of weakness. And anytime anybody knows you got a weakness, they use you. Never seen anybody explore from you used to come because that's the sign of weakness. And more important than anything else. Never reach your hand up out of the gutter, because the minute you do that, somebody comes along and kicks you in the teeth. Now, I didn't want to believe that. But everything way down deep inside of me told me, no, 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 that's not true. But I walked outside of my mother's house that day and made a vow to myself, if I lived to be 500 years old, I'd never show anybody any human emotions again as long as I lived. And I went on in the street corner and got drunk. I went back to school and come home next month and got drunk again. And I guess the rest of my recollection, as far as I can put it together, I was a poor writer. I was a poor writer because I was forced to be a poor writer. They only let me out once a month. I would only get drunk once a month. They let me out, and I'd come running down the street to a brick field window, get me a bottle of Martha Fletcher red wine, sit on the street corner and drink it. And I'd go back to school. My first week would be all right because I was an athlete. I took strenuous exercises.
My second week was all right because I read inspirational books and studied very hard. Then the third week, in the madness started to hit him. So they started to think. Started to think about showing up down in the neighborhood. I started to think about running up the guys that stand on the street corner. And I thought to ask myself, do you remember the guys in the neighborhood that say if I was to walk up to them and tell them, no, I don't want to go out and hit somebody in the head, and I just go play baseball. I wonder what the guys in the neighborhood would say to me if I would tell them I don't want to be a gangster, I want to be a doctor, a lawyer, or an architect. I wonder what they would say. But you see, when you're a guy like me, and you sit in the back with all your life, and you've never stood in anywhere, and you're looking for that pole holding the real interest, and you're sitting in the greatest fingers of this business of living, and you're trying to figure out, what is it that moves you from the blackness and makes you sit out here scared to death to say, do about nothing? The answer comes, it's a bottle of Martha Petrol Red Wine. And so I run down the street corner this one day, and I see my dressing room, and I got my gallon of Martha Petrol Red Wine, and I sit down on the street corner to drink it. And I drank the whole gallon and put more tables on right now, scared to death. Because I didn't imagine it wasn't magic anymore. I didn't know what to do about it, and the guy came along and sat me in the chair, and he said, why don't you try these? And he gave me some pills. And I found out if I ate pills and drank wine, I could make the madness go away for a little while. I wasn't doing this anything else that I was sitting in the sand street corner with a pack of pills and a gallon of wine, and nothing was working. And the guy came along and sat me in the chair, and he said, why don't you try this? And he gave me some morphine. I found out if I put morphine in my arms and scattered pills and drank wine, so I had a combination of things that sustained me for the next 14 years of my life. There was never one that was never paid a combination of everything. I finally became too old to say next year, so I came out of my neighborhood to become a gangster. That was my ambition. I wanted to be the Irish or Lucky Lucy on the Willowbrook. But I had a problem. And I didn't stand up too often. But it's just not conducive to be a gangster. You know, you gotta let the old out there when you're doing the gangster. First thing I run in there and say, check them out and tear up on people. That don't give you too much status when you're talking to the gangsters and IRA, you know. I never could get nothing done, you know, because by the time I got ready to get it done, I was too far gone to do it. Well, I was horizontal, sir. Oh, you know, I was always trying to figure out some way to get up. And I never could. I thought that a guy spent his entire lifetime looking for loyal companions, never found them. I just went in. I just tried hard. I was like that fellow number two. I tried harder than most folks, but I just never stood up to anything. I just never found that place in life where I ever moved into a slot and said, this is it. I sit around trying to impress a bunch of people that I was something I wasn't anytime. Scared me, saw me to death. I was a failure. I joined a gang because I thought there was security of numbers. And I had a reputation for being trusted in my neighborhood, and that's a requirement for being a gangster in most neighborhoods, have a reputation for being trusted. And one of the prime requirements for being tough is you got to be awful scared. You know, you can take a lot of fears and do strange things with them. In my case, I took all of my fears and I turned them into hot cylinders and bars. But the idea is much easier than smack somebody so they found out how scared I was. I didn't know that. I joined the gang because I had a reputation of being a tough kid, and me and the gangsters went out to do a deal one night, and I was going to be the lookout. And they come out from doing a deal, and I was getting arrested for being asleep on the curb. The best possible way I can explain me to you before I found you was, so that I was a murderer. And if you don't know what a murderer was, a murderer is something that sits out in the field and doesn't try to do anything. He just lays up wherever he's at, in his jail or in his nut house, in his hotel room, in his wraparound overcoat or wherever he is, and he says to himself in that moment of clarity, Tomorrow I'm going to get up off this bed, or out of this jail, or out of this nut house, or out of this penitentiary. And I'm going to check out my world, and I'm going to be that great scholar and athlete my teacher said me I was going to be. I'm going to live up to all that fantastic potential I've always been told that I had. But doubt it. Tomorrow I'm going to get up and I'm going to check out my world, and I'm going to be the one thing in the family that somebody's proud of. Tomorrow. So then I took another drink, and I went over into another Netherlands, and I woke up the next morning sick, and the only thing that broke it up was when I got arrested. That was a cycle I lived with all my life. And the only thing that broke it up was when I got arrested and locked up in the nut house. Nothing ever seemed to stop me. I guess I haven't seen the auditorium tonight and tell you without a shot of preservation that any kind of a doubt in my life. Left to my own devices, I'd have been dead before I was 11 years old. That's the type of guy I am. I don't know about most people, and I really know about me, and I'm the type of guy that if I was to start drinking tonight, I wouldn't quit drinking until I was dead or locked up somewhere. I guess the way I am. I never have changed it, and the cycle has never changed, so that's the kind of homicidal person that I really am. I don't know of any neat way to tell you how to quit drinking. Alcoholics Anonymous didn't have any rules about quitting drinking alcohol. The only thing that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous does is keep you out of living quick and meal, living more seriously to put a tumor from in your body. That would be most the truth. Because I've been necessary for me for over 15 years and 8 months of my life. Not to have to put any chemicals in my body to live one day to turn into the third world that used to hate me so much. Didn't know that then. Didn't know it at all. I got arrested again. And they put me last time in the county jail because I lied to them and told them I was in my way, so they put me up there with a gangster. Thought I wanted to be a gangster very badly. Music, we got music tonight. Now, I went to another court battle with my mother, and this time they decided I should go into the United States Army. And I didn't want to go in the Army, I wanted to go to jail where the gangsters was. But they took me out of Alexander County Jail in handcuffs and gave me to the service marshal and told me to pass and told him to be enlisted. And I was in the Army there a while, they told me something I didn't like, so I quit. And they come to get me, and I quit them again. And finally, they got tired of coming to get me, and they quit me. And I came back into my neighborhood and was doing my gangsting career. With about as much success as I ever did anything. And I lived very comfortably in and out of jail for a while. And I think when I was doing a lot of the other alcoholics stream out in your life, well, I ain't hurting nobody but me. If they would just legalize this or legalize that, if they would just leave me alone, everything would be all right. I didn't seem to understand that what was happening to me because at that particular time in my life, I don't know what I was doing at that particular time in my life. I was making a lot of mistakes and falling into a lot of deals. But in 1951, I was residing in the Los Angeles County Jail, and I had something happen to me that just tore my heart out. My mother came to visit me, and she screamed at me through the gate, and she said that I was a murderer. You see, that my baby brother had gotten into some of my prayers and taken an overdose of him dying. And I didn't know how to handle that because prior to coming to prison with Alcoholics Anonymous, if I cared about anything in my life, I cared about my baby brother. And I can't stand and tell you I love my baby brother because I wasn't capable of loving anything. My baby brother was a figment of my own sick ego. I always thought I was going to create something out of him and give him all the opportunities that I never had in life. I remember 2 days later standing out underneath a tree, handcuffed between two detectives where they buried my baby brother. And I had all the guilt and shame and humiliation and degradation of a lifetime hanging on my shoulders, and I wanted to cry and I didn't know how. I didn't have the simple gift of tears that God gives every creature that's born on the face of this earth. And even that didn't happen, so I didn't think it was necessary. I remember my family, how they walked by me and looked at me that day. I remember the look they had in their eyes. They looked at me with that look, now look what you've done. You killed our baby. God, I wanted to turn my baby brother out of the coffin and jump in that form and tell him, now, Jack, you're going to live this life because I'm not worthy enough to live in the world. God, if I had only got in there and killed him out and done something decent once in my life, I'd have felt like it was all right. So I said, all my life, all I had to do was run around here with Sabbath on the people that the Lord and care about. I destroyed everything that came between boundaries of me. And so I just tucked my head down and I walked out into oblivion. And I spent the next few years locked up in a maximum security penitentiary. And I threw him out of that penitentiary and I spent the next 2.5 or 3 years in my life trying to prove that a psychiatrist in San Quentin told me it wasn't true. He said, Johnny, people like you don't change. He says, you're doomed to die in an institution. He took me down the stairs of a little green room one day and said, you're really going to end up here. And I gave him my stock and answering trade. Not me, I'm desperate. After I lost my institution down the terminal, I had that deal beat, and 6 months later I was laying in a nut house, cooking and cleaning. That's when I made my rounds to some of the better laughing academies in the world, interviewing psychiatrists. I'm a psychiatrist interviewer by profession. I learned that on my journey through this thing called alcoholism. I don't know what it was about me and Catiacus. We never seemed to get along too well. Because I'd be sitting there with my wraparound overcoat on, and the fellow would talk to me about my mother. And then I'd talk to him about his mother, and he'd see me how he is. I didn't know. Many of those guys used to have a running fit all the time because they were always talking about something that didn't make any sense to me. They were trying to tell me that I was the way I was because my mother put me on the pot backwards when I was a kid. And I didn't understand them. I didn't understand those. That stuck in my thumb when I was a youngster had to do about me being what I was. You know, I was trying to tell them guys that they missed everything by about 2 feet. They were telling me there was something wrong with that pool and my problem was here. You see, I had a hole in my gut and the wind was twisting through it. And I was at a point in my life where nothing that I was putting in was picking up the hole around it. And it was twisting and screaming and the madness was all about me. And as long as I was awake, the madness was engulfing me. And the only thing that gave me any kind of temporary relief at all was when I took these things in me. And these clowns are sitting there telling me, that's my problem. That's not my problem. That's the answer to my problem. I didn't know that. I wanted to scream out across the table at some of these people sometime and tell them, my God, doctor, don't you understand? I'm scared and I'm lonely and I'm frightened and I don't fit in anywhere. So I'm afraid they'd ask me that great question. What are you afraid of? And I'd have given my great answer. I don't know. I'm just scared. I've always been scared. But you see, I hadn't been to you, so I didn't know the answer to a lot of things people asked me that day because I didn't know anything about my illness. I didn't even know I had an illness. I just thought I was crazy. In the deep and hidden recesses of my mind, I was afraid that those people were going to find out I was absolutely and totally insane. Because what I was doing was the act of an insane person. I didn't know that. I didn't know that to do something against everything you need to tell you that wrong is the act of an insane person. I didn't know that. I didn't know that to drive across the street on the red light when you know a green light of safety is an act of an insane person. I didn't know that. I thought insane people were people who sucked their thumbs and chewed their cane too. Who had shock treatments like they used to give me. I thought that was insanity. And I didn't know that there were other types of insanity. I didn't know that insanity was being against the things that you knew were wrong. To do it anyhow. Even though you knew they were wrong is insanity. I didn't know that. I didn't know that I had a disease called alcoholism. And I didn't know that disease was anything nothing more than a separation from comfort of this ease. God, how separate things get in alcoholics now. I didn't know that. So I'm doing it. I remember 17 years ago, last February, they put me down in the bed in the Los Angeles County Jail and stood over my bed a doctor did one morning and told me I was going to die. I weighed 128 pounds and I was ill and I was strapped down and I was torn straight up. He looked down at me and he said, Tim, you're going to die this one morning and there's nothing I can do for him. I told him, that's it. All day passed and all night passed, the doctor came back into my room the next morning and he stood there and he said the same thing. And I told him, okay. The third day came and the doctor started to come back in my room and had a prayer with me that I'd never known before since in my entire lifetime. And the idea came to me that I was going to live and not die. I was going to get up out of that bed and go to the penitentiary and come back out and start that right race all over again. God knows I didn't want to do that. I was 27 years old and the thing that frightened me more than anything that ever frightened me in my life was the very idea I'd going to live. And right behind that came that other prayer of mine that I was going to die and not find this thing that I always knew existed. I felt kind of cheated about that. So I felt kind of cheated. I lay there for 18 days and 18 nights. I didn't eat, sleep, drink, or anything. I just laid there. And one night, because I didn't know anything better to do, I screamed out down the chair that was sitting right. I said, oh, God, help me. And I thought for a long, long time that nothing happened. But that's not true. From that day to this day, my life has been in different directions. And there ain't no blinding flash of light and no guy come running in the air with a dozen donuts and saying, we got an early meeting down the hall tonight. I know you all there in my delirium to see a guy screaming through this, and I don't want to call it, please, I don't want to see it. The only thing that happened to me was I went to sleep. And the way I kind of like to look at it is that the thing went to sleep and I woke up. Because I stepped out into a world that I didn't even understand. I got up out of that bed and I stepped out into a world where it was just no longer necessary for me to maintain my image, you know. It wasn't necessary for me to be Mr. Flicking by the way, you know. It wasn't necessary for me to be big-time gangster and double-cup and Mr. Flick anymore. It wasn't necessary for me to play all them silly games that I'd been playing on that. I was just tired. My chest didn't have the effort and just wasn't worth it. The people I was trying to impress no longer impressed me. And my world had changed and I didn't understand it. I went into the penitentiary and I spent the next 9 months of my life locked up in solitary confinement, same thing. I said I couldn't stay sober. I couldn't stay sober locked up in an institution. They let me out of the drunk and they put me back in. And finally they transferred me out after a place called the Hatchetry. And 15 years ago last November, on the first weekend of November, on a Sunday morning I was sitting in the yard in the penitentiary called the Hatchetry, and God sent his messengers to me. They didn't think that anything would ever get me at all. I stood around and looked up and I saw a woman walk across the yard. Now, I don't say that you come to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's even my first meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous 15 years and 8 months ago. It's my first meeting, and I've been there ever since. Now, you got to be careful with this. If I don't know where I was coming from, I wouldn't have come. That's what you think they get concerned. I didn't, you know, I was a gangster. Gangsters don't be sitting in there with them wine over. What an image I was trying to maintain. You know, I didn't care. I didn't care how sick that is. You know, 6 months ago, the people I was trying to impress with my image trying to get dragged across the yard and saying, Quentin, you're drunk on that panel throwing up birds and all that other stuff that looks as if it. And now we're in solitary confinement for being drunk and disorderly in a maximum security penitentiary. So that was static. I didn't want anybody to then tough guys to see me sitting in that AA meeting plain and terrible. Because that was beneath my station. I wandered into this room. I started to send this perfume in there. And I sit down in the back row with my coat collar up and the shades on, so that's cool. And I looked up on the back door. I saw two big ears up there. I thought to myself, my God, I wandered into an aircraft again. And I met this clown next to me. I said, what is this? And he said, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. I turned down to my seat. I went back to the big gangster and over the rhino. There had been gangsters anonymous out of been sitting there. Reading the sign, you know, the gangster sign. Or whatever it is now, they change it from time to time, you know. You know, whatever it is, whatever. You know, here's not a changer, but it's still the same thing. It's the mark of ignorance. Yeah. Whatever it is, but it's the same thing. But anyhow, I didn't want him. So I sit around and waited for these women to get up and tell me the way she said. But I knew about women drunk. My mother was a woman drunk, and so was my aunt. And I knew about women drunk. So what did you do? What did you do? Here we want to part up. And the only thing in God's world that gives you a small moment of peace and tranquility. The only thing in God's world that puts you out of the blackness and puts you under the very fingers of living to live it, is these things that you put into you. When this guy talked to me about a way to live, I began instantly interested in what he had to say. And after reading all the messages to the Father, and I said to him, how do you learn how to live? And he looked at me and he smiled and he said, Johnny, there's a book called Alcoholics Anonymous over there in the library. If you go over and get it, I'll go home and pray if you find some part of you in that book. And I went over the next day and I took out the book of Alcoholics Anonymous in the library. And I took it over and I hid it underneath my pillow. Then my third partner went around and started to read it. I mean, my first impression of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought to myself, my God, I found a way to get my mother sober. My mother was the only one who was still coming to the prison camp. One Sunday she got up there to see her son, and she sat down at the bridging table to meet her son, and she looked up and she saw a madman standing there. On the other side of the table, staring littered to that and screaming at the top of his lungs, Mom,
So about to get off all this nonsense, learn how to get sober. My mother left and she didn't come back. But I'm kind of glad of that because the very nature of my own, the very nature of it tells me that if I had anything left to blame for my dilemma, I'd still be out there blaming it. That's sad to God. The very nature of my own is telling me that until I was sick of all things, people, places, things, circumstances, conditions. And the most important thing in life that they took out of me was freedom of choice. So long as I had a freedom of choice, I couldn't come in here and sit and say that God had it not. I don't know about you, but freedom of choice isn't anything more than the day and not of life and death. Because that's what I'm there for. I'm children of life and death. It's my life. I don't come here and say that God had it anonymous, or work the program God had it anonymous, and separate the program God had it anonymous in my life. For any other human being that lives on the face of earth. I do it for me. I do it for me, and I've been doing it for me ever since the first day I've ever found you, and so that's what you tell me I had to do. You tell me there ain't anybody in the world can make this program and say it, Johnny, but if you try to work it, things will get better in your life. And I didn't believe you. You don't know what you got a hold of when you first came to that institution to get a hold of me. What a dream you had. And I was so backwards, I thought that was backwards. I didn't know what was going on. I used to sit around and watch people. They'd make funny statements. You know, there was a bunch of bum things, bum information floating around loose. In this institution, they used to say, I used to hear people say, you've got to get active, and I'll call it now. I used to listen to that. And so I'd go up one day, and the secretary wasn't around, and I snuck up to him. You know, when you're clear, you can't let anybody see you talking to the old secretary. And I said to him, how do you get active? He said, for you, Johnny, you maybe you ought to go down and greet the guests on Sunday and bring them to the movie. I told him, okay. He said, good feeling. I said, ain't it? I don't know how. I walked 1 week. So I went down Sunday and this family come dancing down the aisle. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a wonderful way to stay sober. Come join a happy program. People walk through the gates with them and under the movie. I said, gee, that's nice. Thank you. That seems like I'm walking down there. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the ones who are ready to live by this morning and join our program. They wouldn't come in. And I turned around and shuffled off because they didn't laugh in those days, they shuffled. And I walked up to the secretary and I said to him, hey, man, we won't come in. He said, well, dummy, you got a smile at him. And I said, what's a smile? He said, it's a frown turned upside down. I didn't know that. Good, it's a great, wonderful thing there in our Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. So next week I went bouncing down there. I still shuffled, but I... Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a wonderful way to live. Won't you come join a happy program? I took them into the meeting, put them down, served the dumb coffee, emptied the dumb coffee, kept breaks of dumb coffee, kept them in bed, sitting in the corner and died inside. Because I was still frightened to death, you see, and I was lonely, and I was guilty, and I wasn't excited of this thing. I couldn't move with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said to myself, my God, I've gone so far I can't even be a part of this thing. And I'm doing what they're telling me to do, I'm following these instructions, and I'm wandering around like a smiling idiot. And I don't know what's going on, and I'm dying inside, and I read this dumb book and throw it across the room, because it made no sense to me. Well, one day I looked down at that book, Alcoholics Anonymous, I saw the most simple statement I've ever seen in my life. It said, how it works. I wasn't almost missed it. I live it for something simple. You ever look for the good fairy? You're a good fairy, don't you? That's the fellow who came and checked the wonderfulness of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the guy jumped up here in the bed and said, I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and I've been standing in the golden glory of life ever after, on and on and on. Amen. Everybody used to talk, they used to just sit and pray because I knew the good fairy was coming there very shortly and I wanted to be touched by it. Because I was doing things in Alcoholics Anonymous and I hadn't backed into one since. I know you're there, Cappy. You try to bear with me. You don't want to have any job here. But anyhow, I found it necessary after that for me
to incorporate the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in their life. Now, Lucy, you get misunderstood. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous is in here. It's in this book called Alcoholics Anonymous. So basically what it says on the front of it, a text for Alcoholics Anonymous. That means a cheap dummy like me to live one day at a time. Now sometimes, I seem to be completely confused between a program called Alcoholics Anonymous and a fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's a difference. Really? They're getting ready for us over there, folks. They don't get us over here, they'll get us over there. Anyhow, well, ask the guys that like to come in and share the talk with me a little bit. All right. I take the next year of my life, and I'm grateful for that year. For some of the people who are very grateful for being locked up in an institution, because I'm the type of guy who don't think he's going to make the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and all of them tables out here. Sober one day at a time. I don't think I could have done it. And the reason I don't think I could have done that is because I have a tough time in this business of living the way it is. Because I have nothing but admiration for people who come flirting off the streets and flirting of Alcoholics Anonymous, kick out a drunk, and try to pick up the pieces of his life out there while he's still kicking out that drunk and going out and doing things he's supposed to do. I have nothing but admiration. I couldn't have done that. But you see, I didn't have to, because God knows I couldn't have done it. The next year of my life, fantastic miracles occurred in my life and things I don't even understand. And yet I do understand. And it happened from various places. The first thing that came to me, came to me from a non-alcoholic dentist. The little dentist I love, the little fellow, he's dead now, God rest his soul. He probably did more for me than I'll ever know. And I didn't realize how much he'd done to me until my wife reminded me of it a few months ago. I was a barber in this institution, and I was a personnel barber, and I cut all the free people here in this institution, and I had a vocabulary consisted of about 1,000 four-letter words, and that was it. I didn't know that. I taught I was just a mouthful of guidance that it really was, and I just talked that way all the time. I thought never had two words attached to it. I didn't know any different. And anyhow, one day I'm in there talking to the little dentist, and the little dentist said to me, "Johnny, if you ever get out of this institution, what are you going to do?" And so I gave him my spiel. I went through it for a word to him. And he looked at it over and looked at it kind of carefully. And he said, "When you get out, he says, you'll never make it." And I said, "Why not?" And he said, "Because the minute you open your mouth, people are going to know where you come from." And I said, "What's the matter with my mouth?" He said, "There's nothing wrong with your mouth. You just open it every once in a while." And so I told him, "What am I supposed to do about it, doctor?" And he said, "Well, if you really want to know, if you come over with me on Tuesday night, some of the businessmen and I have a little thing called a gravel club, and we'll try to teach you how to talk." So on Tuesday night for the next 6 or 9 months or a year or whatever it was, I went over and I sit down with the little businessmen of the town, and they word by word, sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph, said me the English language. They told me when I made a mistake, they corrected me when I was wrong, and they patted me when I was wrong. This I found out since I've been hanging around people and all that, it's anonymous, it's an act of love that you very rarely ever find in jail. Somebody will love you enough to correct you, and will love you enough to pat you on the back when you think you're doing right, love you. Somebody that talks you on the back all the time don't necessarily love you. You know, I've asked and wondered about that sometimes, because I'd have a good pat on the back. And so that's one thing I really don't need. I don't really need a lot of pats on the back. I need a lot of correction and a lot of guidance. And I got a sponsor that gives them to me if I can understand them when he's telling me about them sometimes. But I didn't understand that. I knew it would be nice if I had a little bit of sitting there on my chair one day and he said, "Johnny, tonight you get to give a talk." And I said, "Not me. You guys have been up there talking about Omar Khayyam and all them other fellas. You want me to get up there and talk about Captain Marvel and Shazam or some of these kind of things. I don't know what to talk about. What do you want me to talk about?" He said, "Well, why don't you talk about that program that you left for next called Alcoholics Anonymous? What do they do there?" I said, "Well, that's very simple. They just tell you what it's like and what happened to them and what they like to do." He said, well, try that. Tell me later that night with the businessman of the town, and I told him what I was like and what happened to me and where I was trying to get out that door. And they gave me a little statue. God, I love that little statue. I took it home and I put it on the locker. And I looked at my little statue when I went to bed that night. And the first thing I did when I woke up in the morning was look at my little statue. And God, I felt so proud of that. And Father and Susan and I went over to the little meeting with another dummy store up in the top, and he gave me my statue. God, I hated it. You had my statue. I sat there through the whole thing watching with my statue. I watched him when he took my statue home that night. I kind of figured I'd some way to jump out from behind a tree and take my statue back. But I learned a great value from that little statue that I just found out about a couple months ago. I found out that anything that you can see, touch, feel, or hold in the palm of your hand is only a fleeting thing. It's very easy to taste in life with another thing that you can see, touch, hold in the palm of your hand. But the real thing that value in life is what you have in front of you. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that when I was in an institution, I was incorporating values inside of me like peace and happiness and serenity. And I had them in there. I didn't know that. I didn't know that these values were going to be mine that I was going to carry outside of the world into a penitentiary that I came out of that penitentiary 14 years ago, the 4th of this month. And I went home, my mother fell off the steps blind drunk, and I took her and put her on the top and said, Mom, I'm... Yeah. I said, Mom, I'm going to an AA meeting. She said, fine, I think you should. I was very happy to say that a couple of weeks ago, my mother was in an AA meeting as a member of our group. And I'm very proud of that. I'd also like to say that there was something I had to do about that, but I didn't have anything to do with that. I found out from my mother I don't have the power to get anybody sober. I also learned from my mother I don't have the power to get them drunk either. I didn't have any power of my own. It seemed to me that I gave up something on a bed 17 years ago when I tapped the source of power that I carry with me today. I have it with me wherever I go. It just seems to be there whenever I seem to need it. And I seem to need it all the time. I had a guy tell me one time, he said that I was talking to a guy, and he said he was. One time he was talking to me, and he said, well, he said, it seemed like to me that Alcoholics Anonymous was just kind of a back door into heaven. And I looked at him and I said, well, you know that, and I said, thank God that God has a back door for people like me. Because the kind of guy I was, if I'd have stayed up at the front door and the guy would have said in, I'd have said, come in, I wouldn't have felt worthy enough, I'd have told him no thanks. That's the type of guy I was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, because you see, I didn't realize that the kingdom of God was a gift. But all I had to do was reach out and accept my gift. Because it's through my father to his children, all I had to do was reach out and accept and claim it's my gift. You know, if I was to stand here and tell everybody in this room, that right over on the other side of that wall, that all the greatest treasures that have ever been assembled in this world, and all you have to do is just 6 feet straight down and return them. If I ever got that last statement out, I really would be able to try to tear it all apart with a finger. And I stand in front of people and I tell them, as far as I'm concerned, the greatest failure in all of God's life. I was in the presence of the book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, I've heard since I've been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you want to hide anything from an alcoholic, put it in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's true. It's true. You know, those people who are sitting down in meetings with Alcoholics Anonymous, and you tell them, well, you don't have to do nothing, just show up. God, I've always been showing up places all their lives, and people tell them, you don't have to do nothing, just show up. And first thing you know, they look up, and the guy who's showing up ain't showed up anymore. You know? And if you're meeting Alcoholics Anonymous tonight, if you're feeling new, and you're sitting around wondering about whether you're an alcoholic or not, then I'll clear that up to you. If you want to hear you are or you, you are. Those of us who ain't going to worry about it. And I've got a brother who's no alcoholic. I don't know what that does to the idea of inheritance and the degree that I've got of it. But that guy ain't nowhere in the world if he's an alcoholic. My older brother, my same mother, same father, I think. Same uncle, same aunt, same grandfather, same older brother, same younger brother, same deal. But here's the difference. He and I went out to get drunk one night. We took 2 drinks. He quit. I looked at him like he's kind of weird, and I said, "What are you doing in?" He says, "I'm starting to feel it." I thought that's when you stuck it in the overdrive. So that's, you know, that's everybody thinking of working today for what I know of. You know, what is and what ain't. You ever had one in B? You ever sit on one of them airplanes or someplace and watch one of them guys over there drinking and read a book? But if I didn't tie your shoelaces for you, I'll tell them there, you know. You know, I found out, and it's been proven, I'm not. You know, if you're an alcoholic, you are. And if you're instituting drink enough to become one, that's what drives a lot of people crazy, too. If you are, you are. And you're instituting drink enough to become one. It's the same thing with my brother can't drink enough alcohol to become an alcoholic. Matter of fact, he won't. But I don't really worry about my brother. I know that for the first 6 years of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought everything was wonderful. I got to tell him how happy with an Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got to tell everybody how wonderful I was and told him everywhere, and I got to believe him. And I used to wander around when I ride home in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I say to myself, when you get around, you talk a great deal about God and faith and all those other things sometimes. What would happen if something ever happened to you? What would happen if there's 20 million years ever in and you had to put that faith of yours to the test? What would happen? You've been sitting out there, man, that's been coming at you in bunches, too. They've been coming at you. One job, another job, good job, better job, house, wife, kids, the whole bit. I found out for 6 years sober along about this period of my life. 6 years out of an institution about 8 years ago, I was in the deepest depression I'd ever been. Because 2 months prior, I was living in a little house in Lakewood with a woman and two little children. And I got to go to work one day because there was a war going on in my house and I didn't understand it. And I told this woman that I was living here too. She was a non-alcoholic. She was an alcoholic. I don't really know what she was. I told him there was something going on in my house and had to change because I was guilty and feeling guilty about going to meetings at Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was feeling guilty about staying home. And I didn't understand what was going on in the bitterness and the war in my house, and something had to change. And I went to work and an hour later they told me that my God and told me she committed suicide. And I didn't know how to handle that very easily. And I went to where my children were because God was infinite wisdom and took my children at the grandmother's house. And I went to my children, and they were 8 and 4 at the time. And I broke down in front of my 8-year-old daughter, and I started to cry, and she said, "What's the matter, Daddy?" And I said, "See, that's your mother's dead." And then my little 8-year-old girl said to me, "Well, Daddy, I guess Dad needs mommy more than you do." And my little one, the 4-year-old, I didn't tell her. I said, "Jesse, your mother was gone away. And you go get her in the summertime." About a month later, I'm sitting in my house in my bathroom chair, and my little girl came running in across the room, 4 years old, and she was crying. And she was screaming at the chair for me, and she said, "Daddy, you lied to me. You told me my mother went away, and the little girl across the street said my mother's dead." Now, what about that? And I said, "Well, see, that's supposing that I told you that the mother went to live with God." And she got up in my lap, and she broke into a big old smile, and she kissed me on the cheek. She said, "Well, that's all right then, Daddy." And she got on off of my lap, and I heard her run across the yard, yelling at her little friend, "It's all right. My mom is living with God." And you know, if I don't ever contribute anything at all to my children, nothing at all, I'm grieving my God that I learned about an alcoholic mom. I learned about a nice, kind God who loves me regardless of what I do. He asked that I do nothing more one day in my life and just live to the best of my ability one day at a time out there. That's all God asked me. You see, last night to me when I lay down upon my bed over there, and I hold my eyes back in prayer and I say to my God, "Papa, I'm kind of sorry because I didn't do as well today as I should have done." You see, like when I tell God that, He says to me, "It's all right, son. Try a little bit harder tomorrow." See, when I get up tomorrow morning and I tell my God to release me from the bondage of self, that I may be witness to those who see it and run down and make me well on me. But somehow or other, I kind of continue to tap that strength of power for carrying me through a day of living out there with the lions and the tigers in the jungle out there. My life has been fantastic because 7 years ago, from the 4th of July, we don't have a picnic around here. 8 years ago, on the 4th of July, I went to a picnic in Long Beach, and a little woman with blue eyes, 5'2", with an Indian, and the sky offered me a piece of chicken. And I've been eating chicken ever since. And I've learned a great lesson from that woman. I learned what love is. Real love. I'm not talking about that, tell it how it is, sort of thing. I'm talking about somebody who loves me enough to correct me when I'm wrong. My wife has taught me many great lessons. She taught me one time when I quit smoking. You know, big deal, I quit smoking about 6 years ago last January. I went through all the pains of hell quitting smoking. I kicked and screamed and carried the bag and jumped up and down. That was just a real picture of surrendering and peace. And after about 2 or 3 weeks of that madness, I'd kind of subsided and I'd just settled into being completely insane. And a guy I love very much, guy sponsor, I love him very much, this guy, he called me on the telephone. He had a very serious heart attack. And the doctor put him on a very strict diet and told him to quit smoking. And the guy couldn't. God is so guilty about that, so he called me. He said, "Johnny," he said, "I understand this diet, but I can't quit smoking. What do you think I ought to do about it?" And me and my husband, "Just leave the program and hang up on it." And I turned around and there stood that little woman of mine out there. And she said, "Sit down." And I said, "John," she said, "you know I love you?" And I said, "Well, sure, I know you love me." She said, "We want to tell the truth every once in a while." I said, "I don't understand what you're talking about," and I didn't. She said, "Some of us would like to know the pain of you hurt, just like all the rest of us." And I thought to myself, "My God, that's true." And I went back and I called my phone up on the telephone, my friend, and I said to him, "I want to tell you that I'm sorry. I want to tell you I have no trouble quitting smoking once you come down off the wall." And if you help me, God, I hope I'll never forget his answer. He said to me, "Thank God, Johnny. I thought maybe I was working the wrong program." And I thought to myself, I wonder how many times a big man has been in the meeting and some little group has wandered up to him and said, "Blah, blah, blah. Sorry, I can't just use your program. You're not going to be all right in smoking. But to do that and not have it now in this meeting, maybe you could cure the person who asked the question." Do you ever stop thinking of that? I guess one of my greatest thoughts when you say the name of Alcoholics Anonymous is with my impatience and my arrogance. So I seem to somehow kind of forget what it used to be like. What happens, what it's like today, and if I don't take care of what it's like today, it's going to be like it was yesterday, tomorrow. Now the greatest thing that happened to me today was my friend took me down a long cross street. I always kind of like to go down there. You know, when you've been flying in airplanes, drink that coffee and live high in the hog and think you're stepping in tall cotton. I always have to go down there on Skid Row and see me, but for the grace of God. And I saw a little fellow there laying in the doorway with his legs crossed, talking to a doormouth. He was a nice little guy. And another fellow seemed to have lost his shirt yesterday sometime. He was lying down, checking his thumb, having a tremendous conversation. Another little fellow kind of got tired, so he laid his chin down the rest in the parking meter. And I thought, "There, but for the grace of God, stand by. There, but for the grace of God, stand by." And I just kind of made that trip a little bit there and made me a little more grateful. And I'm grateful for the fellow that took me down there. I'm grateful for it. Because you see, I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic, and what I've been given in this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous is a daily reprieve from this illness that's killing me one day at a time, contingent and maintenance on certain spiritual truths. And it says in my book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that my only job is to fit me to be of maximum service to God and the people about me. That's my only business. And sometimes I forget that because I think my business is something else. And my business ain't nothing else. My business, good, bad, and different, is an example of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous works. Here's a day last Sunday. I got the 16-year-old girl that I found out of town, tried to find and get a diploma from high school. Now there was nothing strange about that. There were 500 young ladies getting diplomas that day. But you see, this one 16-year-old girl, that was my girl. This was a girl who was born in New Hall at Green Pine in San Quentin. But a psychiatrist and a doctor and a judge got together and said, by all rights and probabilities, I was never supposed to lay eyes on this child. Told her mother to take her as far away from me as she could possibly ever take her because I would never be of any maximum benefit to her using it. And I stood there and I cried and said, my daughter was standing there getting that thing. And I didn't understand it. But the people who were sitting in the air understood it because they were all members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was my wife sitting next to me and my youngest daughter who was 13 years old. The way we talk about an alcoholic community, we talk about a past. So every side of our past we talk about. Past is real narrow in alcoholic community. By really passing the years, it's narrow and there's mystery to alcoholics over there in the years. And I've walked along the path of alcoholic community for a long time. And along this path in this thing called alcoholic community, there's filth in the world. And every time I come to a church in the world in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's been some member of Alcoholics Anonymous standing there and they're telling me, this is the way we go, man. We go down this path down there. And then the type of guy I am, I kind of stop and I listen and I hear the mystery down there. The lions and tigers down there, dealing and carrying on. And I say to myself, well, you know, it's all right for you to walk down that path down there, but I'm different. I'm going to go down there and see because this may be my opportunity to make that big score. And so I go down there and them lions and tigers pull me up and throw me back on the path. And I come back scratched and bloody and bruised and I'm picking myself up. And Miss Fonsi smiles and he picks me up and he puts his arms around my shoulders. He says, now we're up on this path. And I said, man, I'll tell you one thing, man, I ain't never going down that other path again. Until we come to the next fork in the road. And he got his arms around my shoulder and he said, now down that path is the lions and the tigers and this time there's a gorilla down there. Well, that's all right for you, Norm. But I'm different. I can handle it. I'll go around and meet you down there. Get in there and get my brains kicked out. But you see, I haven't always taken the wrong path in the road. I've always said, now sometimes I said, okay, sometimes I put them sitting around and I walk out down the path in the sunshine and I bask in the warm sunshine of the Spirit. That's what I've done since I've been hanging around people like you. I'm the guy who's sitting in the blackness all his life and all the other ones do is settle to the gray and you come into a bunch of people like you and you step them out in the warm sunshine and to bask in the warmth of the Spirit. And that's what I've been doing 15 years and 8 months. I've been basking in the warmth of the Spirit. And from time to time I change from the light and come into the darkness and become frightened and scared like a little kid. Now I don't know what to do about it and sometimes I have to turn completely around until I can get back into the light again. But you know it's kind of nice to know that all you got to do is keep on turning and moving and go. And there you stand, the people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a fantastic thing, this thing called life. I love this thing. I love Alcoholics Anonymous and I love everything about it. The greatest thing in life that's ever happened to me is having me since I've been an alcoholic now. Not only have I been given the privilege to be a husband and a father and a citizen out there in the world, the state of California has given me but all the privileges of motherhood. You know what I'm saying? The last thing you ever did before you left your town was find my favorite unconditional pardon. They're Muslim. And I didn't think that was ever going to happen, so I didn't answer it when I came here. The only thing I asked for when I came back, I had a command and sit down, was the same thing I asked for you today. That you just let me come in here and sit and run and run and run and run and bask in the sunshine of the Spirit. Let me kind of rub shoulders with you and hang on to you and walk down this thing called life with you.
One John talking to another for that matter tonight, and there's some confusion amongst people. So now you're really worried about the Christians in alcoholics anonymous, you're worried about one John getting sober. You're fine. If you're worried about the Christians in our fellowship alcoholics anonymous, you're just filled with disaster. Because I don't know how many of you came in here in a busload, I didn't. I came here one drunk looking for another drunk. And the greatest pleasure I have in life is the ability or the privilege to sit down and talk with another drunk, one living up. Just like me and my son did, riding in our truck today, up and down the street. I like to see you tonight and thank you for every living thing that I have. I like to thank you for the way that I feel inside. I like to thank you for the tears that I took back and cried out. I like to thank you for the happy heart and happy home and the warmth and the same kind of spirit that I've brought you in most of the days of my life. I like to thank you for every living thing that I am. I don't even want to tell you anything that I like to know, darling. I like to thank you for the way of feeling. One time I went to see somebody because I was puzzled and nearly dying, and this lady saved my life. And I wanted to thank her. I wanted to thank her for what I'd been given in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't know how. And I wanted to thank her for all the things I just wanted to thank you for. And I said to her, Nick, how do I thank you? How do I thank the people of Alcoholics Anonymous for these things that are mine abundant? And she looked at me and she smiled and she had the most beautiful blue eyes you've ever seen in your life. And she said this to me. She said, sweetheart, there's only one way in God's world that you could ever express your gratitude in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's to remain a good example of what this program can do for you. And I hope and pray to God I always will. Thank you. Thank you.